Valentine didn't know what to make of Ender. It was only her second day on Lusitania, but already she was sure that something was wrong. Not that there weren't grounds for Ender to be worried, distracted. He had filled her in on the problems the xenobiologists were having with the Descolada, the tensions between Grego and Quara, and of course there was always the Congress fleet, death looming over them from every sky. But Ender had faced worries and tensions before, many times in his years as a speaker for the dead. He had plunged into the problems of nations and families, communities and individuals, struggling to understand and then to purge and heal the diseases of the heart. Never had he responded the way he was acting now. Or perhaps he had. Once. When they were children, and Ender was being groomed to command the fleets being sent against all the bugger worlds, they had brought Ender back to Earth for a season, the lull before the final storm, as it turned out. Ender and Valentine had been apart since he was 5 years old, not allowed so much as an unsupervised letter between them. Then, suddenly, they changed their policy and brought Valentine to him. He was being kept at a large private estate near their hometown, spending his days swimming and, more often, floating in utter languor on a private lake. At first, Valentine had thought all was well, and she was merely glad to see him at last. But soon she understood that something was deeply wrong. Only in those days she hadn't known Ender so well. After all, he'd been apart from her for more than half his life. Yet she knew that it was wrong for him to seem so preoccupied. No, that wasn't really it. He wasn't preoccupied. He was unoccupied. He had detached himself from the world, and her job was to reconnect him, to bring him back and show him his place in the web of humanity. Because she succeeded, he was able to go back into space and command the fleets that utterly destroyed the buggers. Ever since that time, his connection with the rest of humanity seemed secure. Now again, she had been apart from him for half a lifetime. 25 years for her, 30 for him. And again he seemed to be detached. She studied him as he took her and Miro and Plicht out by car, skimming over the endless prairies of Caping. "We're like a little boat on the ocean," said Ender. "Not really," she said, remembering the time that Yacht had taken her out on one of the small net-laying launches, the 3-meter waves that lifted them high, then plunged them down into the trench between. On the large fishing boat, those waves had barely jostled them as they nestled comfortably in the sea, but in the tiny launch, the waves were overwhelming, literally breathtaking. She had to slide down from her seat onto the deck, embracing the plank bench with both arms before she could catch her breath. There was no comparison between the heaving, pitching ocean and this placid, grassy plain. Then again, maybe to Ender, there was. Maybe when he saw the acres of Caping, he saw within it the Descolada virus, malevolently adapting itself to slaughter humankind and all its companion species. Maybe to him this prairie rolled and shrugged every bit as brutally as the ocean. The sailors had laughed at her, not mockingly, but tenderly, like parents laughing at the fears of a child. "These seas are nothing," they said. "You should try doing this in 20-meter seas." Ender was as calm outwardly as the sailors had been, calm, unconnected, making conversation with her and Miro and Silent Plick, but still holding something back. Is there something wrong between Ender and Novinia? Valentine hadn't seen them together long enough to know what was natural between them and what was strained. Certainly there were no obvious quarrels. So perhaps Ender's problem was a growing barrier between him and the community of Milagre. That was possible. Valentine certainly remembered how hard it had been for her to win acceptance from the Trondheimers, and she had been married to a man with enormous prestige among them. How was it for Ender, married to a woman whose whole family had already been alienated from the rest of Milagre? Could it be that his healing of this place was not as complete as anyone supposed? Not possible. When Valentine met with the mayor, Covano Zeliejo, and with old Bishop Peregrino that morning, they had shown genuine affection for Ender. Valentine had attended too many meetings not to know the difference between formal courtesies, political hypocrisies, and genuine friendship. If Ender felt detached from these people, it wasn't by their choice. "I'm reading too much into this," thought Valentine. "If Ender seems to be strange and detached, it's because we have been apart so long. Or perhaps because he feels shy with this angry young man, Miro. Or perhaps it's Plicht, with her silent, calculating worship of Ender Wiggin, who makes him choose to be distant with us. Or maybe it's nothing more than my insistence that I must meet the Hive Queen today, at once, even before meeting any of the leaders of the Piggies. There's no reason to look beyond present company for the cause of his unconnection." They first located the Hive Queen's city by the pall of smoke. "Fossil fuels," said Ender. "She's burning them up at a disgusting rate. Ordinarily, she'd never do that. The Hive Queens tend their worlds with great care, and they never make such a waste and a stink. But there's a great hurry these days, and Human says that they've given her permission to burn and pollute as much as necessary." "Necessary for what?" asked Valentine. "Human won't say, and neither will the Hive Queen, but I have my guesses, and I imagine you will too. Are the Piggies hoping to jump to a fully technological society in a single generation, relying on the Hive Queen's work?" "Hardly," said Ender. "They're far too conservative for that. They want to know everything there is to know, but they aren't terribly interested in surrounding themselves with machines. Remember that the trees of the forest freely and gently give them every useful tool. What we call industry still looks like brutality to them."
"What then? Why all this smoke?"
"Ask her," said Ender. "Maybe she'll be honest with you."
"Will we actually see her?" asked Miro.
"Oh, yes," said Ender. "Or at least, we'll be in her presence. She may even touch us, but perhaps the less we see, the better. It's usually dark where she lives, unless she's near to egg-laying. At that time, she needs to see, and the workers open tunnels to bring in daylight."
"They don't have artificial light?" asked Miro.
"They never used it," said Ender. "Even on the starships that came to Sol System back during the Bugger Wars, they see heat the way we see light. Any source of warmth is clearly visible to them. I think they even arranged their heat sources in patterns that could only be interpreted aesthetically. Thermal painting."
"So why do they use light for egg-laying?" asked Valentine.
"I'd hesitate to call it a ritual. The Hive Queen has such scorn for human religion. Let's just say it's part of their genetic heritage. Without sunlight, there's no egg-laying."
Then they were in the Bugger City.
Valentine wasn't surprised at what they found. After all, when they were young, she and Ender had been with the first colony on Rove, a former Bugger world. But she knew that the experience would be surprising and alien to Miro and Plicht, and in fact, some of the old disorientation came back to her, too. Not that there was anything obviously strange about the city. There were buildings, most of them low, but based on the same structural principles as any human buildings. The strangeness came in the careless way they were arranged. There were no roads and streets, no attempt to line up the buildings to face the same way, nor did buildings rise out of the ground to any common height. Some were nothing but a roof resting on the ground. Others rose to a great height. Paint seemed to be used only as a preservative. There was no decoration. Ender had suggested that heat might be used aesthetically. It was a sure thing that nothing else was.
"It makes no sense," said Miro.
"Not from the surface," said Valentine, remembering Rove. "But if you could travel the tunnels, you'd realize that it all makes sense underground. They follow the natural seams and textures of the rock. There's a rhythm to geology, and the buggers are sensitive to it."
"What about the tall buildings?" asked Miro.
"The water table is their downward limit. If they need greater height, they have to go up."
"What are they doing that requires a building so tall?" asked Miro.
I don't know, said Valentine.
They were skirting a building that was at least 300 meters high. In the near distance, they could see more than a dozen others. For the first time on this excursion, Plickt spoke up.
Rockets, she said.
Valentine caught a glimpse of Ender smiling a bit and nodding slightly. So Plickt had confirmed his own suspicions.
What for? Asked Miro.
Valentine almost said, to get into space, of course. But that wasn't fair. Miro had never lived on a world that was struggling to get into space for the first time. To him, going off-planet meant taking the shuttle to the orbiting station. But the single shuttle used by the humans of Lusitania would hardly do for transporting material outward for any kind of major deep space construction program. And even if it could do the job, the Hive Queen was unlikely to ask for human help.
What's she building? A space station? Asked Valentine.
I think so, said Ender. But so many rockets, and such large ones. I think she's planning to build it all at once, probably cannibalizing the rockets themselves. What do you think the throw might be?
Valentine almost answered with exasperation, How should I know?
Then she realized that he wasn't asking her, because almost at once he supplied the answer himself, which meant that he must have been asking the computer in his ear. No, not a computer. Jane. He was asking Jane. It was still hard for Valentine to get used to the idea that even though there were only 4 people in the car, there was a 5th person present, looking and listening through the jewels Ender and Miro both wore.
She could do it all at once, said Ender. In fact, given what's known about the chemical emissions here, the Hive Queen has smelted enough metal to construct not only a space station, but also 2 small long-range starships of the sort that the first Bugger expedition brought, their version of a colony ship.
Before the fleet arrives, said Valentine. She understood at once. The Hive Queen was preparing to emigrate. She had no intention of letting her species be trapped on a single planet when the little doctor came again.
You see the problem, said Ender. She won't tell us what she's doing, so we have to rely on what Jane observes and what we can guess. And what I'm guessing isn't a very pretty picture.
What's wrong with the buggers getting off planet? Asked Valentine.
Not just the buggers, said Miro. Valentine made the second connection. That's why the Pecaninos had given permission for the Hive Queen to pollute so badly. That's why there were 2 ships planned right from the first.
A ship for the Hive Queen and a ship for the Pecaninos.
That's what they intend, said Ender. But the way I see it is 2 ships for the Descolada.
Nossa Senora, whispered Miro.
Valentine felt a chill go through her. It was one thing for the Hive Queen to seek the salvation of her species, but it was quite another thing for her to carry the deadly self-adapting virus to other worlds.
You see my quandary, said Ender. You see why she won't tell me directly what she's doing.
But you couldn't stop her anyway, could you? Asked Valentine.
He could warn the Congress fleet, said Miro.
That's right. Dozens of heavily armed starships, converging on Lusitania from every direction. If they were warned about 2 starships leaving Lusitania, if they were given their original trajectories, they could intercept them, destroy them.
You can't, said Valentine. I can't stop them, and I can't let them go, said Ender. To stop them would be to risk destroying the buggers and the piggies alike. To let them go would be to risk destroying all of humanity.
You have to talk to them. You have to reach some kind of agreement.
What would an agreement with us be worth? Asked Ender. We don't speak for humanity in general, and if we make threats, the Hive Queen will simply destroy all our satellites and probably our Ansible as well. She may do that anyway, just to be safe.
Then we'd really be cut off, said Miro.
From everything, said Ender.
It took Valentine a moment to realize that they were thinking of Jane. Without an Ansible, they couldn't speak to her anymore. And without the satellites that orbited Lusitania, Jane's eyes in space would be blinded.
"Ender, I don't understand," said Valentine. "Is the Hive Queen our enemy?"
"That's the question, isn't it?" asked Ender. "That's the trouble with restoring her species. Now that she has her freedom again, now that she's not bundled up in a cocoon hidden in a bag under my bed, the Hive Queen will act in the best interest of her species, whatever she thinks that is."
"But, Ender, it can't be that there has to be war between humans and buggers again. If there were no human fleet heading toward Lusitania, the question wouldn't come up."
"But Jane has disrupted their communications," said Valentine. "They can't receive the order to use the little doctor."
"For now," said Ender.
"But, Valentine, why do you think Jane risked her own life in order to cut off their communications?"
"Because the order was sent.
Starway's Congress sent the order to destroy this planet. And now that Jane has revealed her power, they'll be all the more determined to destroy us. Once they find a way to get Jane out of the way, they'll be even more certain to act against this world."
"Have you told the Hive Queen?"
"Not yet. But then, I'm not sure how much she can learn from my mind without my wanting her to. It's not exactly a means of communication that I know how to control."
Valentine put her hand on Ender's shoulder. "Was this why you tried to persuade me not to come to see the Hive Queen? Because you didn't want her to learn the real danger?"
"I just don't want to face her again," said Ender. "Because I love her and I fear her. Because I'm not sure whether I should help her or try to destroy her. And because once she gets those rockets into space, which could be any day now, she could take away our power to stop her. Take away our connection with the rest of humanity."
And again, what he didn't say, she could cut Ender and Miro off from Jane.
"I think we definitely need to have a talk with her," said Valentine.
"Either that or kill her," said Miro.
"Now you understand my problem," said Ender. They rode on in silence. The entrance to the Hive Queen's burrow was a building that looked like any other. There was no special guard. Indeed, in their whole excursion, they hadn't seen a single bugger. Valentine remembered when she was young, on her first colony world, trying to imagine what the bugger cities had looked like when they were fully inhabited. Now she knew they looked exactly the way they did when they were dead. No scurrying buggers like ants swarming over the hills. Somewhere, she knew, there were fields and orchards being tended under the open sun, but none of that was visible from here.
Why did this make her feel so relieved?
She knew the answer to the question even as she asked it. She had spent her childhood on Earth during the Bugger Wars. The insectoid aliens had haunted her nightmares, as they had terrified every other child on Earth. Only a handful of human beings, however, had ever seen a bugger in person, and few of those were still alive when she was a child. Even in her first colony, where the ruins of bugger civilization surrounded her, they had found not even one desiccated corpse. All her visual images of the buggers were the horrifying images from the vids. Yet wasn't she the first person to have read Ender's book, The Hive Queen? Wasn't she the first, besides Ender, to come to think of the Hive Queen as a person of alien grace and beauty? She was the first, yes, but that meant little. Everyone else alive today had grown up in a moral universe shaped in part by the Hive Queen and the Hegemon, while she and Ender were the only two left alive who had grown up with the steady campaign of loathing toward the buggers. Of course, she felt irrational relief at not having to see the buggers. To Miro and Plick, the first sight of the Hive Queen and her workers wouldn't have the same emotional tension that it had for her.
"I am Demosthenes," she reminded herself. "I'm the theorist who insisted that the buggers were Raman, aliens who could be understood and accepted. I must simply do my best to overcome the prejudices of my childhood. In due time, all of humanity will know of the reemergence of the Hive Queen. It would be shameful if Demosthenes were the one person who could not receive the Hive Queen as Raman."
Ender took the car in a circle around a smallish building. "This is the right place," he said. He pulled the car to a stop, then slowed the fan to settle it onto the capping near the building's single door. The door was very low. An adult would have to go through on hands and knees.
How do you know?
Asked Miro.
Because she says so, said Ender. Jane?
Asked Miro.
He looked puzzled, because of course Jane had said nothing of the sort to him.
The Hive Queen, said Valentine. She speaks directly into Ender's mind.
Nice trick, said Miro. Can I learn it? We'll see, said Ender, when you meet her.
As they clambered off the car and dropped into the tall grass, Valentine noticed how Miro and Ender both kept glancing at Pleaked. Of course, it bothered them that Pleaked was so quiet, or rather, seemed so quiet. Valentine thought of Pleaked as a loquacious, eloquent woman. But she had also got used to the way Pleaked played the mute at certain times. Ender and Miro, of course, were only discovering her perverse silence for the first time, and it bothered them, which was one of the main reasons Pleaked did it. She believed that people revealed themselves most when they were vaguely anxious, and few things brought out nonspecific anxieties like being in the presence of a person who never speaks. Valentine didn't think much of the technique as a way of dealing with strangers, but she had watched how, as a tutor, Plick's silences forced her students, Valentine's children, to deal with their own ideas. When Valentine and Ender taught, they challenged their students with dialogue, questions, arguments. But Pleaked forced her students to play both sides of an argument, proposing their own ideas, then attacking them in order to refute their own objections. The method probably wouldn't work for most people. Valentine had concluded that it worked so well for Pleaked because her wordlessness was not complete non-communication. Her steady, penetrating gaze was in itself an eloquent expression of skepticism. When a student was confronted with that unblinking regard, he soon succumbed to all his own insecurities. Every doubt that the student had managed to put aside and ignore now forced itself forward, where the student had to discover within himself the reasons for Plick's apparent doubt. Valentine's oldest, Sifta, had called these one-sided confrontations staring into the sun. Now Ender and Miro were taking their own turn at blinding themselves in a contest with the all-seeing eye and the not-saying mouth. Valentine wanted to laugh at their unease, to reassure them. She also wanted to give Plicked a gentle little slap and tell her not to be difficult. Instead of doing either, Valentine strode to the door of the building and pulled it open. There was no bolt, just a handle to grasp. The door opened easily. She held it open as Ender dropped to his knees and crawled through. Plicked followed immediately. Then Miro sighed and slowly sank to his knees. He was more awkward in crawling than he was in walking. Each movement of an arm or leg was made individually, as if it took a second to think of how to make it go. At last he was through, and now Valentine ducked down and squat-walked through the door. She was the smallest, and she didn't have to crawl. Inside, the only light came from the door. The room was featureless, with a dirt floor. Only as Valentine's eyes became used to the darkness did she realize that the darkest shadow was a tunnel sloping down into the earth. "There aren't any lights down in the tunnels," Ender said. "She'll direct me. You'll have to hold on to each other's hands. Valentine, you go last, all right?"
"Can we go down standing up?" asked Miro.
The question clearly mattered.
"Yes," said Ender. "That's why she chose this entrance."
They joined hands, Plicked holding Ender's hand, Miro between the two women. Ender led them a few steps down the slope into the tunnel. It was steep, and the utter blackness ahead was daunting. But Ender stopped before the darkness became absolute.
"What are we waiting for?" asked Valentine.
"Our guide," said Ender.
At that moment, the guide arrived. In the darkness, Valentine could barely see the black reed arm with a single finger and thumb as it nudged Ender's hand. Immediately, Ender enclosed the finger within his left hand. The black thumb closed like a pincer over his hand. Looking up the arm, Valentine tried to see the bugger it belonged to. All she could actually make out, though, was a child-sized shadow.
and perhaps a slight gleam of reflection off a carapace. Her imagination supplied all that was missing, and against her will, she shuddered. Miro muttered something in Portuguese. So he too was affected by the presence of the bugger. Flicht, however, remained silent, and Valentine couldn't tell whether she trembled or remained entirely unaffected. Then Miro took a shuffling forward step, pulling on Valentine's hand, leading her forward into the darkness.
Ender knew how hard this passage would be for the others. So far, only he, Novinia, and Ella had ever visited the Hive Queen, and Novinia had come only the once. The darkness was too unnerving to move endlessly downward without help of eyes, knowing from small sounds that there was life and movement, invisible but nearby. "Can we talk?" asked Valentine. Her voice sounded very small. "It's a good idea," said Ender. "You won't bother them. They don't take much notice of sound." Miro said something. Without being able to see his lips move, Ender found it harder to understand Miro's speech. "What?" asked Ender. "We both want to know how far it is," Valentine said. "I don't know," said Ender. "From here, anyway. And she might be almost anywhere down here. There are dozens of nurseries. But don't worry, I'm pretty sure I could find my way out." "So could I," said Valentine. "With a flashlight, anyway." "No light," said Ender. "The egg-laying requires sunlight, but after that, light only retards the development of the eggs, and at one stage it can kill the larvae." "But you could find your way out of this nightmare in the dark?" asked Valentine. "Probably," said Ender. "There are patterns, like spider webs. When you sense the overall structure, each section of tunnel makes more sense." "These tunnels aren't random?" Valentine sounded skeptical. "It's like the tunneling on Eros," said Ender. He really hadn't had that much chance to explore when he lived on Eros as a child soldier. The asteroid had been honeycombed by the buggers when they made it their forward base in the Sol system. It became fleet headquarters for the human allies after it was captured during the first bugger war. During his months there, Ender had devoted most of his time and attention to learning to control fleets of starships in space. Yet he must have noticed much more about the tunnels than he realized at the time, because the first time the Hive Queen brought him into her burrows on Lusitania, Ender found that the bends and turns never seemed to take him by surprise. They felt right. No, they felt inevitable. "What's Eros?" asked Miro. "An asteroid near Earth," said Valentine, "the place where Ender lost his mind." Ender tried to explain to them something about the way the tunnel system was organized, but it was too complicated. Like fractals, there were too many possible exceptions to grasp the system in detail. It kept eluding comprehension the more closely you pursued it. Yet to Ender, it always seemed the same, a pattern that repeated over and over. Or maybe it was just that Ender had got inside the hive mind somehow when he was studying them in order to defeat them. Maybe he had simply learned to think like a bugger. In which case, Valentine was right. He had lost part of his human mind, or at least added onto it a bit of the hive mind. Finally, when they turned a corner, there came a glimmer of light.
"Gracias a Deus," whispered Miro.
Ender noted with satisfaction that Plicht, this stone woman who could not possibly be the same person as the brilliant student he remembered, also let out a sigh of relief. Maybe there was some life in her after all. "Almost there," said Ender. "And since she's laying, she'll be in a good mood."
"Doesn't she want privacy?" asked Miro.
"It's like a minor sexual climax that goes on for several hours," said Ender. "It makes her pretty cheerful. Hive queens are usually surrounded only by workers and drones that function as part of themselves. They never learn shyness." In his mind, though, he could feel the intensity of her presence. She could communicate with him any time, of course, but when he was close, it was as if she were breathing into his brain pan. It became heavy, oppressive. Did the others feel it? Would she be able to speak to them? With Ella, there had been nothing. Ella never caught a glimmer of the silent conversation. As for Novenia, she refused to speak of it and denied having heard anything, but Ender suspected that she had simply rejected the alien presence. The Hive Queen said she could hear both their minds clearly enough as long as they were present, but couldn't make herself heard. Would it be the same with these today? It would be such a good thing if the Hive Queen could speak to another human. She claimed to be able to do it, but Ender had learned over the past 30 years that the Hive Queen was unable to distinguish between her confident assessments of the future and her sure memories of the past. She seemed to trust her guesses every bit as much as she trusted her memories. And yet, when her guesses turned out wrong, she seemed not to remember that she had ever expected a different future from the one that now was past. It was one of the quirks of her alien mind that disturbed Ender most. Ender had grown up in a culture that judged people's maturity and social fitness by their ability to anticipate the results of their choices. In some ways, the Hive Queen seemed markedly deficient in this area. For all her great wisdom and experience, she seemed as boldly and unjustifiably confident as a small child. That was one of the things that frightened Ender about dealing with her. Could she keep a promise? If she failed to keep one, would she even realize what she had done?
Valentine tried to concentrate on what the others were saying, but she couldn't take her eyes off the silhouette of the bugger leading them. It was smaller than she had ever imagined, no taller than 1.5 meters, probably less. Looking past the others, she could only glimpse parts of the bugger, but that was almost worse than seeing it whole. She couldn't keep herself from thinking that this shiny black enemy had a death grip on Ender's hand. Not a death grip. Not an enemy. Not even a creature in itself. It had as much individual identity as an ear or a toe. Each bugger was just another of the Hive Queen's organs of action and sensation. In a sense, the Hive Queen was already present with them, was present wherever one of her workers or drones might be, even hundreds of light years away. This is not a monster. This is the very Hive Queen written of in Ender's book. This is the one he carried with him and nurtured during all our years together, though I didn't know it. I have nothing to fear. Valentine had tried suppressing her fear, but it wasn't working. She was sweating. She could feel her hand slipping in Miro's palsied grip. As they got closer and closer to the Hive Queen's lair, no, her home, her nursery, she could feel herself getting more and more frightened. If she couldn't handle it alone, there was no choice but to reach out for help. Where was Yacht? Someone else would have to do. "I'm sorry, Miro," she whispered. "I think I've got the sweats." "You?" he said. "I thought it was my sweat." That was good. He laughed. She laughed with him, or at least giggled nervously. The tunnel suddenly opened wide, and now they stood blinking in a large chamber with a shaft of bright sunlight stabbing through a hole in the vault of the ceiling. The Hive Queen was smack in the center of the light. There were workers all around, but now, in the light, in the presence of the Queen, they all looked so small and fragile. Most of them were closer to 1 meter than 1.5 meters in height, while the Queen herself was surely 3 meters long. And height wasn't the half of it. Her wing covers looked vast, heavy, almost metallic, with a rainbow of colors reflecting sunlight. Her abdomen was long and thick enough to contain the corpse of an entire human, yet it narrowed, funnel-like, to an ovipositor at the quivering tip, glistening with a yellowish translucent fluid, gluey, stringy. It dipped into a hole in the floor of the room, deep as it could go, and then came back up, the fluid trailing away like unnoticed spittle, down into the hole. Grotesque and frightening as this was, a creature so large acting so much like an insect, it did not prepare Valentine for what happened next. For instead of simply dipping her ovipositor into the next hole, the Queen turned and seized one of the workers hovering nearby. Holding the quivering bugger between her large forelegs, she drew it close and bit off its legs, one by one. As each leg was bitten off, the remaining legs gesticulated ever more wildly, like a silent scream. Valentine found herself desperately relieved when the last leg was gone, so that the scream was at last gone from her sight. Then the Hive Queen pushed the unlimbed worker headfirst down the next hole. Only then did she position her ovipositor over the hole. As Valentine watched, the fluid at the ovipositor's tip seemed to thicken into a ball. But it wasn't fluid after all, or not entirely. Within the large drop was a soft, jelly-like egg. The Hive Queen maneuvered her body so that her face was directly in the sunlight, her multiplex eyes shining like hundreds of emerald stars. Then the ovipositor plunged downward. When it came up, the egg still clung to the end, but on the next emergence, the egg was gone. Several times more, her abdomen dipped downward, each time coming up with more strands of fluid stringing downward from the tip.
Nossa Senora, said Miro.
Valentine recognized it from its Spanish equivalent, Nuestra Señora, Our Lady. It was usually an almost meaningless expression, but now it took on a repulsive irony. Not the Holy Virgin, here in this deep cavern. The Hive Queen was Our Lady of the Darkness, laying eggs over the bodies of lying workers to feed the larvae when they hatched.
It can't always be this way, said Plickt.
For a moment, Valentine was simply surprised to hear Plickt's voice. Then she realized what Plickt was saying, and she was right. If a living worker had to be sacrificed for every bugger that hatched, it would be impossible for the population to increase. In fact, it would have been impossible for this hive to exist in the first place, since the Hive Queen had to give life to her first eggs without the benefit of any legless workers to feed them.
Only a new queen.
It came into Valentine's mind, as if it were her own idea. The Hive Queen only had to place a living worker's body into the egg casing when the egg was supposed to grow into a new Hive Queen. But this wasn't Valentine's own idea. It felt too certain for that. There was no way she could know this information, and yet the idea came clearly, unquestionably, all at once. As Valentine had always imagined that ancient prophets and mystics heard the voice of God.
Did you hear her? Any of you? Asked Ender.
Yes, said Plickt.
I think so, said Valentine.
Hear what? Asked Miro.
The Hive Queen, said Ender. She explained that she only has to place a worker into the egg casing when she's laying the egg of a new Hive Queen. She's laying five. There are two already in place. She invited us to come to see this. It's her way of telling us that she's sending out a colony ship. She lays five queen eggs and then waits to see which is strongest. That's the one she sends.
What about the others? Asked Valentine.
If any of them is worth anything, she cocoons the larva. That's what they did to her. The others she kills and eats. She has to. If any trace of a rival queen's body should touch one of the drones that hasn't yet mated with this Hive Queen, it would go crazy and try to kill her. Drones are very loyal mates.
Everybody else heard this? Asked Miro. He sounded disappointed. The Hive Queen wasn't able to talk to him.
Yes, said Plickt. Only a bit of it, said Valentine.
Empty your mind as best you can, said Ender. Get some tune going in your head. That helps.
In the meantime, the Hive Queen was nearly done with the next set of amputations. Valentine imagined stepping on the growing pile of legs around the queen. In her imagination, they broke like twigs with hideous, snapping sounds.
Very soft. Legs don't break. Bend,
The queen was answering her thoughts.
You are part of Ender. You can hear me.
The thoughts in her mind were clearer, not so intrusive now, more controlled. Valentine was able to feel the difference between the Hive Queen's communications and her own thoughts.
Uvi, whispered Miro.
He had heard something at last.
Fala mais, escuto. Say more. I'm listening. Philotic connections. You are bound to Ender. When I talk to him through the philotic link, you overhear echoes, reverberations.
Valentine tried to conceive how the Hive Queen was managing to speak Stark into her mind. Then she realized that the Hive Queen was almost certainly doing nothing of the kind. Miro was hearing her in his native language, Portuguese, and Valentine wasn't really hearing Stark at all. She was hearing the English that it was based on, the American English that she had grown up with. The Hive Queen wasn't sending language to them. She was sending thought, and their brains were making sense of it in whatever language lay deepest in their minds. When Valentine heard the word echoes, followed by reverberations, it wasn't the Hive Queen struggling for the right word. It was Valentine's own mind grasping for words to fit the meaning.
Bound to him, like my people. Except you have free will. Independent Philote. Rogue people, all of you. She's making a joke, whispered Ender. Not a judgment.
Valentine was grateful for his interpretation. The visual image that came with the phrase rogue people was of an elephant stomping a man to death. It was an image out of her childhood, the story from which she had first learned the word rogue. It frightened her, that image, the way it had frightened her as a child. She already hated the Hive Queen's presence in her mind, hated the way she could dredge up forgotten nightmares. Everything about the Hive Queen was a nightmare. How could Valentine ever have imagined that this being was Raman? Yes, there was communication, too much of it. Communication like mental illness. And what was she saying? That they heard her so well because they were philotically connected to Ender? Valentine thought back to what Miro and Jane had said during the voyage. Was it possible that her philotic strand was twined into Ender and through him to the Hive Queen? But how could such a thing have happened? How could Ender ever have become bound to the Hive Queen in the first place?
We reached for him. He was our enemy, trying to destroy us. We wanted to tame him like a rogue.
The understanding came suddenly, like a door opening. The buggers weren't all born docile. They could have their own identity, or at least a breakdown of control. And so the Hive Queens had evolved a way of capturing them, binding them philotically to get them under control.
Found him, couldn't bind him, too strong.
And no one guessed the danger Ender was in. That the Hive Queen expected to be able to capture him, make him the same kind of mindless tool of her will as any bugger.
Set up a web for him. Found the thing he yearned for. We thought. Got into it. Gave it a philotic core. Bonded with him.
But it wasn't enough. Now you... You...
Valentine felt the word like a hammer inside her mind. She means me. She means me. 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 She struggled to remember who me was. Valentine. I'm Valentine. She means Valentine.
You were the one. You should have found you. What he longed for most. Not the other thing.
It gave her a sick feeling inside. Was it possible that the military was correct all along? Was it possible that only their cruel separation of Valentine and Ender saved him? That if she had been with Ender, the buggers could have used her to get control of him?
No. Could not do it. You are also too strong. We were doomed. We were dead. He couldn't belong to us. But not to you either. Not anymore. Couldn't tame him. But we twined with him.
Valentine thought of the picture that had come to her mind on the ship, of people twined together, families tied by invisible cords, children to parents, parents to each other, or to their own parents, a shifting network of strings tying people together wherever their allegiance belonged. Only now the picture was of herself, tied to Ender, and then of Ender tied to the Hive Queen, the queen shaking her ovipositor, the strands quivering. And at the end of the strand, Ender's head, wagging, bobbing. She shook her head, trying to clear away the image.
We don't control him. He's free. He can kill me if he wants. I won't stop him. Will you kill me?
This time the you was not Valentine. She could feel the question recede from her. And now, as the Hive Queen waited for an answer, she felt another thought in her mind. So close to her own way of thinking that if she hadn't been sensitized, if she hadn't been waiting for Ender to answer, she would have assumed it was her own natural thought. Never, said the thought in her mind. I will never kill you. I love you. And along with this thought came a glimmer of genuine emotion toward the Hive Queen. All at once, her mental image of the Hive Queen included no loathing at all. Instead, she seemed majestic, royal, magnificent. The rainbows from her wing covers no longer seemed like an oily scum on water. The light reflecting from her eyes was like a halo. The glistening fluids at the tip of her abdomen were the threads of life, like milk at the nipple of a woman's breast, stringing with saliva to her baby's suckling mouth. Valentine had been fighting nausea till now. Yet suddenly she almost worshipped the Hive Queen. Oh, it was Ender's thought in her mind. She knew that. Well, that's why the thoughts felt so much like her own.
And with his vision of the Hive Queen, she knew at once that she had been right all along, when she wrote as Demosthenes so many years before. The Hive Queen was Raman. Strange, but still capable of understanding and being understood. As the vision faded, Valentine could hear someone weeping. Plicht. In all their years together, Valentine had never heard Plicht show such frailty.
Bonita, said Miro.
Pretty. Was that all he had seen?
The Hive Queen was pretty? The communication must be weak indeed between Miro and Ender. But why shouldn't it be? He hadn't known Ender that long or that well, while Valentine had known Ender all her life. But if that was why Valentine's reception of Ender's thought was so much stronger than Miro's, how could she explain the fact that Plicht had so clearly received far more than Valentine? Was it possible that in all her years of studying Ender, of admiring him without really knowing him, Plicht had managed to bind herself more tightly to Ender than even Valentine was bound? Of course she had. Of course. Valentine was married. Valentine had a husband. She had children. Her philotic connection to her brother was bound to be weaker, while Plicht had no allegiance strong enough to compete. She had given herself wholly to Ender. So with the Hive Queen making it possible for the philotic twines to carry thought, of course Plicht received Ender most perfectly. There was nothing to distract, no part of herself withheld. Could even Novenia, who after all was tied to her children, have such a complete devotion to Ender? It was impossible. And if Ender had any inkling of this, it had to be disturbing to him, or attractive. Valentine knew enough of men and women to know that worship was the most seductive of attributes. Have I brought a rival with me to trouble Ender's marriage? Can Ender and Plicht read my thoughts, even now? Valentine felt deeply exposed, frightened. As if in answer, as if to calm her, the Hive Queen's mental voice returned, drowning out any thoughts that Ender might be sending.
I know what you're afraid of, but my colony won't kill anyone. When we leave Lusitania, we can kill all the Descolada virus on our starship.
Maybe, thought Ender.
We'll find a way. We won't carry the virus. We don't have to die to save humans. Don't kill us. Don't kill us.
I'll never kill you. Ender's thought came like a whisper, almost drowned out in the Hive Queen's pleading.
We couldn't kill you anyway, thought Valentine. It's you who could easily kill us. Once you build your starships, your weapons, you could be ready for the human fleet. Ender isn't commanding them this time.
Never. Never kill anybody. Never. We promised.
Peace, came Ender's whisper. Peace. Be at peace. Calm. Quiet. Rest. Fear nothing. Fear no man.
Don't build a ship for the piggies, thought Valentine. Build a ship for yourself, because you can kill the Descolada you carry, but not for them. The Hive Queen's thoughts abruptly changed from pleading to harsh rebuke.
Don't they also have a right to live? I promised them a ship. I promised you never to kill. Do you want me to break promises?
No, thought Valentine. She was already ashamed of herself for having suggested such a betrayal. Or were those the Hive Queen's feelings? or Ender's? Was she really sure which thoughts and feelings were her own, and which were someone else's? The fear she felt. It was her own. She was almost certain of that. "Please," she said, "I want to leave."
"Eu también,"
said Miro. Ender took a single step toward the Hive Queen, reached out a hand toward her. She didn't extend her arms. She was using them to jam the last of her sacrifices into the egg chamber. Instead, the queen raised a wing cover, rotated it, moved it toward Ender, until at last his hand rested on the black rainbow surface.
"Don't touch it," cried Valentine silently. "She'll capture you. She wants to tame you."
"Hush," said Ender aloud. Valentine wasn't sure whether he was speaking in answer to her silent cries, or was trying to silence something the Hive Queen was saying only to him. It didn't matter. Within moments, Ender had hold of a bugger's finger and was leading them back into the dark tunnel. This time he had Valentine second, Miro third, and Plickt bringing up the rear, so that it was Plickt who cast the last look backward toward the Hive Queen. It was Plickt who raised her hand in farewell. All the way up to the surface, Valentine struggled to make sense of what had happened. She had always thought that if only people could communicate mind to mind, eliminating the ambiguities of language, then understanding would be perfect, and there'd be no more needless conflicts. Instead, she had discovered that rather than magnifying differences between people, language might just as easily soften them, minimize them, smooth things over so that people could get along even though they really didn't understand each other. The illusion of comprehension allowed people to think they were more alike than they really were. Maybe language was better. They crawled out of the building into the sunlight, blinking, laughing in relief, all of them.
"Not fun," said Ender. "But you insisted, Val. Had to see her right away."
"So I'm a fool," said Valentine. "Is that news?"
"It was beautiful," said Plickt.
Miro only lay on his back in the caping and covered his eyes with his arm. Valentine looked at him lying there and caught a glimpse of the man he used to be, the body he used to have. Lying there, he didn't stagger. Silent, there was no halting in his speech. No wonder his fellow Xenologer had fallen in love with him. Wanda. So tragic to discover that her father was also his father. That was the worst thing revealed when Ender spoke for the dead in Lusitania 30 years ago. This was the man that Wanda had lost. And Miro had also lost this man that he was. No wonder he had risked death crossing the fence to help the piggies. Having lost his sweetheart, he counted his life as worthless. His only regret was that he hadn't died after all. He had lived on, broken on the outside as he was broken on the inside. Why did she think of these things, looking at him? Why did it suddenly seem so real to her? Was it because this was how he was thinking of himself right now? Was she capturing his image of himself? Was there some lingering connection between their minds? "Ender," she said, "what happened down there?"
"Better than I hoped," said Ender.
"What was?"
"The link between us."
"You expected that?"
"Wanted it."
Ender sat on the side of the car, his feet dangling in the tall grass.
"She was hot today, wasn't she?"
"Was she? I wouldn't know how to compare. Sometimes she's so intellectual. It's like doing higher mathematics in my head, just talking to her. This time, like a child. Of course, I've never been with her when she was laying queen eggs. I think she may have told us more than she meant to."
"You mean she didn't mean her promise?"
"No, Val, no. She always means her promises. She doesn't know how to lie."
"Then what did you mean?"
"I was talking about the link between me and her. How they tried to tame me. That was really something, wasn't it?" She was furious there for a moment,
when she thought that you might have been the link they needed. You know what that would have meant to them? They wouldn't have been destroyed. They might even have used me to communicate with the human governments, shared the galaxy with us. Such a lost opportunity. You would have been like a bugger, a slave to them. Sure, I wouldn't have liked it, but all the lives that would have been saved? I was a soldier, wasn't I? If one soldier dying can save the lives of billions. But it couldn't have worked. You have an independent will, said Valentine. Sure, said Ender. Or at least more independent than the Hive Queen can deal with. You too. Comforting, isn't it?
I don't feel very comforted right now, said Valentine. You were inside my head down there. And the Hive Queen, I feel so violated.
Ender looked surprised. It never feels that way to me.
Well, it's not just that, said Valentine. It was exhilarating, too, and frightening. She's so large inside my head, like I'm trying to contain someone bigger than myself.
I guess, said Ender. He turned to Plicht. Was it like that for you, too? For the first time, Valentine realized how Plicht was looking at Ender, with eyes full, a trembling gaze. But Plicht said nothing.
That's strong, huh? Said Ender.
He chuckled and turned to Miro.
Didn't he see? Plicht had already been obsessed with Ender. Now, having had him inside her mind, it might have been too much for her.
The Hive Queen talked of taming rogue workers. Was it possible that Plicht had been tamed by Ender? Was it possible that she had lost her soul inside his?
Absurd. Impossible. I hope to God it isn't so.
Come on, Miro, said Ender. Miro allowed Ender to help him to his feet. Then they climbed back onto the car and headed home to Milagre.
Miro had told them that he didn't want to go to Mass. Ender and Novenia went without him, but as soon as they were gone, he found it impossible to remain in the house. He kept getting the feeling that someone was just outside his range of vision. In the shadows, a smallish figure watching him. Encased in smooth, hard armor, only two claw-like fingers on its slender arms, arms that could be bitten off and cast down like brittle kindling wood. Yesterday's visit to the Hive Queen had bothered him more than he dreamed possible. I'm a xenologer, he reminded himself. My life has been devoted to dealing with aliens. I stood and watched as Ender flayed human's mammaloid body, and I didn't even flinch, because I'm a dispassionate scientist. Sometimes maybe I identify too much with my subjects, but I don't have nightmares about them. I don't start seeing them in shadows. Yet here he was, standing outside the door of his mother's house, because in the grassy fields, in the bright sunlight of a Sunday morning, there were no shadows where a bugger could wait to spring. Am I the only one who feels this way? The Hive Queen isn't an insect. She and her people are warm-blooded, just like the Pequeninos. They respirate, they sweat like mammals. They may carry with them the structural echoes of their evolutionary link with insects, just as we have our resemblances to lemurs and shrews and rats, but they created a bright and beautiful civilization, or at least a dark and beautiful one. I should see them the way Ender does, with respect, with awe, with affection. And all I managed, barely, was endurance. There's no doubt that the Hive Queen is Raman, capable of comprehending and tolerating us. The question is whether I am capable of comprehending and tolerating her. And I can't be the only one. Ender was so right to keep the knowledge of the Hive Queen from most of the people of Lusitania. If they once saw what I saw, or even caught a glimpse of a single bugger, the fear would spread. Each one's terror would feed on everyone else's dread until something. Something bad, something monstrous. Maybe we're the Varelsa. Maybe xenocide is built into the human psyche as into no other species. Maybe the best thing that could happen for the moral good of the universe is for the Descarlata to get loose, to spread throughout the human universe and break us down to nothing. Maybe the Descarlata is God's answer to our unworthiness. Miro found himself at the door of the cathedral. In the cool morning air, it stood open. Inside, they had not yet come to the Eucharist. He shuffled in, took his place near the back. He had no desire to commune with Christ today. He simply needed the sight of other people. He needed to be surrounded by human beings. He knelt, crossed himself, then stayed there, clinging to the back of the pew in front of him, his head bowed. He would have prayed, but there was nothing in the Pai Nosso to deal with his fear. Give us this day our daily bread. Forgive us our trespasses. Thy kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. That would be good. God's kingdom in which the lion could dwell with a lamb. Then there came to his mind an image of St. Stephen's vision. Christ sitting at the right hand of God. But on the left hand was someone else. The Queen of Heaven. Not the Holy Virgin, but the Hive Queen, with whitish slime quivering on the tip of her abdomen. Miro clenched his hands on the wood of the pew before him. God, take this vision from me. Get thee behind me, enemy. Someone came and knelt beside him. He didn't dare to open his eyes. He listened for some sound that would declare his companion to be human. But the rustling of cloth could just as easily be wing casings sliding across a hardened thorax. He had to force this image away. He opened his eyes. With his peripheral vision, he could see that his companion was kneeling. From the slightness of the arm, from the color of the sleeve, it was a woman. "You can't hide from me forever," she whispered. The voice was wrong. Too husky. A voice that had spoken 100,000 times since he last heard it. A voice that had crooned to babies, cried out in the throes of love, shouted at children to come home, come home. A voice that had once, when it was young, told him of a love that would last forever. "Miro, if I could have taken your cross upon myself, I would have done it." "My cross? Is that what it is I carry around with me, heavy and sluggish, weighing me down? And here I thought it was my body. I don't know what to tell you, Miro. I grieved for a long time. Sometimes I think I still do. Losing you, our hope for the future, I mean, it was better anyway. That's what I realized. I've had a good family, a good life, and so will you. But losing you as my friend, as my brother, that was the hardest thing. I was so lonely. I don't know if I ever got over that. Losing you as my sister was the easy part. I didn't need another sister. You break my heart, Miro. You're so young. You haven't changed. That's the hardest thing. You haven't changed in 30 years. It was more than Miro could bear in silence. He didn't lift his head, but he did raise his voice. Far too loudly for the middle of Mass, he answered her,
"Haven't I?"
He rose to his feet, vaguely aware that people were turning around to look at him.
"Haven't I?"
His voice was thick, hard to understand, and he was doing nothing to make it any clearer. He took a halting step into the aisle, then turned to face her at last.
"This is how you remember me?"
She looked up at him, aghast. At what? At Miro's speech, his palsied movements? Or simply that he was embarrassing her, that it didn't turn into the tragically romantic scene she had imagined for the past 30 years. Her face wasn't old, but it wasn't Wanda either. Middle-aged, thicker, with creases at the eyes. How old was she? 50 now? Almost. What did this 50-year-old woman have to do with him?
"I don't even know you," said Miro.
Then he lurched his way to the door and passed out into the morning. Sometime later, he found himself resting in the shade of a tree. Which one was this, rooter or human? Miro tried to remember. But it was only a few weeks ago that he left here, wasn't it? But when he left, human's tree was still only a sapling, and now both trees looked to be about the same size, and he couldn't remember for sure whether human had been killed uphill or downhill from rooter. It didn't matter. Miro had nothing to say to a tree, and they had nothing to say to him. Besides, Miro had never learned tree language. They hadn't even known that all that beating on trees with sticks was really a language until it was too late for Miro. Ender could do it, and Wanda, and probably half a dozen other people, but Miro would never learn, because there was no way Miro's hands could hold the sticks and beat the rhythms. Just one more kind of speech that was now useless to him. Che diacciato, mio figlio. That was one voice that would never change. And the attitude was unchanging as well. What a rotten day, my son. Pious and snide at the same time, and mocking himself for both points of view.
Hi, King.
Father Estevan now, I'm afraid. King had adopted the full regalia of a priest, robes and all. Now he gathered them under himself and sat on the worn-down grass in front of Miro.
You look the part, said Miro.
King had matured well. As a kid, he had looked pinched and pious. Experience with the real world instead of theological theory had given him lines and creases, but the face that resulted had compassion in it, and strength.
Sorry I made a scene at Mass.
Did you? Asked King. I wasn't there. Or rather, I was at Mass, I just wasn't at the cathedral.
Communion for the Raman?
For the children of God. The church already had a vocabulary to deal with strangers. We didn't have to wait for Demosthenes.
Well, you don't have to be smug about it, King. You didn't invent the terms.
Let's not fight.
Then let's not butt into other people's meditations.
A noble sentiment, except that you have chosen to rest in the shade of a friend of mine with whom I need to have a conversation. I thought it was more polite to talk to you first before I start beating on Rooter with sticks.
This is Rooter?
Say hi. I know he was looking forward to your return.
I never knew him.
But he knew all about you. I don't think you realize, Miro, what a hero you are among the Pequeninos. They know what you did for them and what it cost you.
And do they know what it's probably going to cost us all in the end?
In the end, we'll all stand before the judgment bar of God. If a whole planet full of souls is taken there at once, then the only worry is to make sure no one goes unchristened whose soul might have been welcomed among the saints.
So you don't even care?
I care, of course, said King. But let's say that there's a longer view, in which life and death are less important matters than choosing what kind of life and what kind of death we have.
You really do believe all this, don't you? Said Miro.
Depending on what you mean by all this, yes, I do.
I mean all of it. A living God, a resurrected Christ, miracles, visions, baptism, transubstantiation.
Yes.
Miracles, healing.
Yes.
Like at the shrine to grandfather and grandmother.
Many healings have been reported there.
Do you believe in them?
Miro, I don't know. Some of them might have been hysterical. Some might have been a placebo effect. Some purported healings might have been spontaneous remissions or natural recoveries.
But some were real.
Might have been.
You believe that miracles are possible?
Yes.
But you don't think any of them actually happen?
Miro, I believe that they do happen. I just don't know if people accurately perceive which events are miracles and which are not. There are no doubt many miracles claimed which were not miracles at all. There are also probably many miracles that no one recognized when they occurred.
What about me, King?
What about you?
Why no miracle for me?
King ducked his head, pulled at the short grass in front of him. It was a habit when he was a child, trying to avoid a hard question. It was the way he responded when their supposed father, Marcão, was on a drunken rampage.
What is it, King? Are miracles only for other people?
Part of the miracle is that no one knows why it happens.
What a weasel you are, King.
King flushed. You want to know why you don't get a miraculous healing? Because you don't have faith, Miro.
What about the man who said, Yes, Master, I believe,
Forgive my unbelief. Are you that man? Have you even asked for a healing?
I'm asking now,
said Miro. And then, unbidden, tears came to his eyes.
Oh, God, he whispered. I'm so ashamed.
Of what? Asked King. Of having asked God for help? Of crying in front of your brother? Of your sins? Of your doubts? Miro shook his head. He didn't know. These questions were all too hard. Then he realized that he did know the answer. He held out his arms from his sides.
Of this body, he said.
King reached out and took his arms near the shoulder, drew them toward him, his hands sliding down Miro's arms until he was clasping Miro's wrists. This is my body, which is given for you, he told us, the way you gave your body for the pequeninos, for the little ones.
Yeah, King, but he got his body back, right?
He died, too.
Is that how I get healed? Find a way to die?
Don't be an ass, said King. Christ didn't kill himself. That was Judas's ploy. Miro's anger exploded.
All those people who get their colds cured, who get their migraines miraculously taken from them, are you telling me they deserve more from God than I do?
Maybe it isn't based on what you deserve. Maybe it's based on what you need. Miro lunged forward, seizing the front of King's robe between his half-spastic fingers.
I need my body back.
Maybe, said King.
What do you mean, maybe, you simpering, smug asshole?
I mean, said King mildly, that while you certainly want your body back, it may be that God, in his great wisdom, knows that for you to become the best man you can be, you need to spend a certain amount of time as a cripple.
How much time? Miro demanded.
Certainly no longer than the rest of your life. Miro grunted in disgust and released King's robe. Maybe less, said King. I hope so.
Hope,
said Miro contemptuously. Along with faith and pure love, it's one of the great virtues. You should try it.
I saw Wanda.
She's been trying to speak to you since you arrived.
She's old and fat. She's had a bunch of babies and lived 30 years, and some guy she married has plowed her up one side and down the other all that time. I'd rather have visited her grave.
How generous of you.
You know what I mean. Leaving Lusitania was a good idea, but 30 years wasn't long enough.
You'd rather come back to a world where no one knows you.
No one knows me here either.
Maybe not, but we love you, Miro.
You love what I used to be.
You're the same man, Miro. You just have a different body. Miro struggled to his feet, leaning against Ruter for support as he got up.
Talk to your tree friend, King. You've got nothing to say that I want to hear.
So you think, said King.
You know what's worse than an asshole, King?
Sure, said King. A hostile, bitter, self-pitying, abusive, miserable, useless asshole who has far too high an opinion of the importance of his own suffering. It was more than Miro could bear. He screamed in fury and threw himself at King, knocking him to the ground. Of course, Miro lost his own balance and fell on top of his brother, then got tangled in King's robes. But that was all right. Miro wasn't trying to get up. He was trying to beat some pain into King, as if by doing that he would remove some from himself. After only a few blows, though, Miro stopped hitting King and collapsed in tears, weeping on his brother's chest. After a moment, he felt King's arms around him, heard King's soft voice intoning a prayer. Pai nosso, que estás no céu. From there, however, the incantation stopped, and the words turned new and therefore real.
O teu filho está com dor. O meu irmão precisa a ressurreição da alma. Ele merece o refresco da esperança.
Hearing King gave voice to Miro's pain, to his outrageous demands, made Miro ashamed again. Why should Miro imagine that he deserved new hope? How could he dare to demand that King pray for a miracle for him, for his body to be made whole? It was unfair, Miro knew, to put King's faith on the line for a self-pitying unbeliever like him. But the prayer went on.
Él deu tudo aos pequeninos, e tú nos disseste, Salvador, que cualquier cosa que fazemos a estes pequeninos, fazemos a ti.
Miro wanted to interrupt. If I gave all to the pequeninos, I did it for them, not for myself. But King's words held him silent. You told us, Savior, that whatever we do to these little ones, we do to you. It was as if King were demanding that God hold up his end of a bargain. It was a strange sort of relationship that King must have with God, as if he had a right to call God to account.
Ele não é como Jean, perfeito na coração.
No, I'm not as perfect as Job. But I've lost everything, just as Job did. Another man fathered my children on the woman who should have been my wife. Others have accomplished my accomplishments. And where Job had boils, I have this lurching half-paralysis. Would Job trade with me?
Restabeleci ele, como restabeleceste, Jean, em nome do Pai, e do Filho, e do Espírito Santo. Amém.
Restore him as you restored Job. Miro felt his brother's arms release him, and as if it were those arms, not gravity, that held him on his brother's chest, Miro rose up at once and stood looking down on his brother. A bruise was growing on King's cheek. His lip was bleeding.
I hurt you, said Miro. I'm sorry.
Yes, said King, you did hurt me. And I hurt you. It's a popular pastime here. Help me up. For a moment, just one fleeting moment, Miro forgot that he was crippled, that he could barely maintain his balance himself. For just that moment, he began to reach out a hand to his brother. But then he staggered as his balance slipped, and he remembered.
I can't, he said.
Oh, shut up about being crippled and give me a hand. So Miro positioned his legs far apart and bent down over his brother. His younger brother, who now was nearly 3 decades his senior, and older still in wisdom and compassion. Miro reached out his hand. King gripped it, and with Miro's help, rose up from the ground. The effort was exhausting for Miro. He hadn't the strength for this, and King wasn't faking it. He was relying on Miro to lift him. They ended up facing each other, shoulder to shoulder, hands still together.
You're a good priest, said Miro.
Yeah, said King, and if I ever need a sparring partner, you'll get a call.
Will God answer your prayer?
Of course. God answers all prayers. It took only a moment for Miro to realize what King meant.
I mean, will he say yes?
Ah, that's the part I'm never sure about. Tell me later if he did. King walked, rather stiffly, limping, to the tree. He bent over and picked up a couple of talking sticks from the ground.
What are you talking to Reuter about?
He sent word that I need to talk to him. There's some kind of heresy in one of the forests a long way from here.
You convert them and then they go crazy, huh?
Said Miro. No, actually, said King. This is a group that I never preached to. The father trees all talk to each other, so the ideas of Christianity are already everywhere in the world. As usual, heresy seems to spread faster than truth. And Reuter's feeling guilty because it's based on a speculation of his.
I guess that's a serious business for you, said Miro.
King winced. Not just for me.
I'm sorry, I meant for the church, for believers.
Nothing so parochial as that, Miro. These pequeninos have come up with a really interesting heresy. Once, not long ago, Reuter speculated that just as Christ came to human beings, the Holy Ghost might someday come to the pequeninos. It's a gross misinterpretation of the Holy Trinity, but this one forest took it quite seriously.
Sounds pretty parochial to me.
Me too. Till Reuter told me the specifics. You see, they're convinced that the Descolada virus is the incarnation of the Holy Ghost. It makes a perverse kind of sense, since the Holy Ghost has always dwelt everywhere in all God's creations. It's appropriate for its incarnation to be the Descolada virus, which also penetrates into every part of every living thing.
They worship the virus?
Oh, yes. After all, didn't you scientists discover that the Pequeninos were created as sentient beings by the Descolada virus? So the virus is imbued with a creative power, which means it has a divine nature.
I guess there's as much literal evidence for that as for the incarnation of God in Christ.
No, there's a lot more. But if that were all, Miro, I'd regard it as a church matter. Complicated, difficult, but, as you said, parochial.
So what is it?
The Descolada is the second baptism, by fire. Only the Pequeninos can endure that baptism, and it carries them into the third life. They are clearly closer to God than humans, who have been denied the third life.
The mythology of superiority. We could expect that, I guess, said Miro. Most communities attempting to survive under irresistible pressure from a dominant culture develop a myth that allows them to believe they are somehow a special people, chosen, favored by the gods. Gypsies, Jews, plenty of historical precedents.
Try this one, Señor Zenador. Since the Pequeninos are the ones chosen by the Holy Ghost, it's their mission to spread this second baptism to every tongue and every people.
Spread the Descolada?
To every world. Sort of a portable judgment day. They arrive, the Descolada spreads, adapts, kills, and everybody goes to meet their maker.
God help us.
So we hope. Then Miro made a connection with something he had learned only the day before.
King, the buggers are building a ship for the Pequeninos.
So Ender told me. And when I confronted Father Daymaker about it...
He's a Pequenino?
One of humans' children. He said, of course, as if everyone knew about it. Maybe that's what he thought, that if the Pequeninos know it, then it's known. He also told me that this heretic group is angling to try to get command of the ship.
Why?
So they can take it to an inhabited world, of course, instead of finding an uninhabited planet to terraform and colonize.
I think we'd have to call it luciforming.
Funny. King wasn't laughing, though. They might get their way. This idea of Pequeninos being a superior species is popular, especially among non-Christian Pequeninos. Most of them aren't very sophisticated. They don't catch on to the fact that they're talking about xenocide, about wiping out the human race.
How could they miss a little fact like that?
Because the heretics are stressing the fact that God loves the humans so much that he sent his only beloved son. You remember the scripture.
Whoever believes in him will not perish.
Exactly. Those who believe will have eternal life. As they see it, the third life.
So those who die must have been the unbelievers.
Not all the Pequeninos are lining up to volunteer for service as itinerant destroying angels. But enough of them are that it has to be stopped, not just for the sake of Mother Church.
Mother Earth.
So you see, Miro, sometimes a missionary like me takes on a great deal of importance in the world. Somehow, I have to persuade these poor heretics of the error of their ways and get them to accept the doctrine of the church.
Why are you talking to Reuter now?
To get the one piece of information the Pequeninos never give us.
What's that?
Addresses. There are thousands of Pequenino forests on Lusitania. Which one is the heretic community? Their starship will be long gone before I find it by random forest hopping on my own.
You're going alone?
I always do. I can't take any of the little brothers with me, Miro. Until a forest has been converted, they have a tendency to kill Pequenino strangers. One case where it's better to be Raman than Utlaning.
Does Mother know you're going?
Please be practical, Miro. I have no fear of Satan. But Mother...
Does Andrew know?
Of course. He insists on going with me. The Speaker for the Dead has enormous prestige, and he thinks he could help me.
So you won't be alone?
Of course I will. When has a man clothed in the whole armor of God ever needed the help of a humanist?
Andrew's a Catholic.
He goes to Mass, he takes communion, he confesses regularly, but he's still a Speaker for the Dead, and I don't think he really believes in God. I'll go alone. Miro looked at King with new admiration.
You're one tough son of a bitch, aren't you?
Welders and smiths are tough. Sons of bitches have problems of their own. I'm just a servant of God and of the church, with a job to do. I think recent evidence suggests that I'm in more danger from my brother than I am among the most heretical of Pecaninos. Since the death of Human, the Pecaninos have kept the worldwide oath. Not one has ever raised a hand in violence against a human being. They may be heretics, but they're still Pecaninos. They'll keep the oath.
I'm sorry I hit you.
I received it as if it were an embrace, my son.
I wish it had been one, Father Estevan.
Then it was. King turned to the tree and began to beat out a tattoo. Almost at once, the sound began to shift, changing in pitch and tone as the hollow spaces within the tree changed shape. Miro waited a few moments, listening, even though he didn't understand the language of the Father Trees. Reuter was speaking with the only audible voice the Father Trees had. Once he had spoken with a voice, once had articulated with lips and tongue and teeth. There was more than one way to lose your body. Miro had passed through an experience that should have killed him. He had come out of it crippled, but he could still move, however clumsily, could still speak, however slowly. He thought he was suffering like Job. Reuter and Human, far more crippled than he, thought they had received eternal life.
"Pretty ugly situation," said Jane in his ear.
"Yes," said Miro silently.
"Father Estevan shouldn't go alone," she said. "The Pecaninos used to be devastatingly effective warriors. They haven't forgotten how."
"So tell Ender," said Miro. "I don't have any power here."
"Bravely spoken, my hero," said Jane. "I'll talk to Ender while you wait around here for your miracle."
Miro sighed and walked back down the hill and through the gate.
9. Pinehead.
I've been talking to Ender and his sister Valentine. She's a historian.
Explain this?
She searches through the books to find out the stories of humans, and then writes stories about what she finds and gives them to all the other humans.
If the stories are already written down, why does she write them again?
Because they aren't well understood. She helps people understand them.
If the people closer to that time didn't understand them, how can she, coming later, understand them better?
I asked this myself, and Valentine said that she doesn't always understand them better. But the old writers understood what the stories meant to the people of their time, and she understands what the stories mean to people of her time.
So, the story changes.
Yes.
And yet, each time, they still think of the story as a true memory?
Valentine explained something about some stories being true and others being truthful. I didn't understand any of it.
Why don't they just remember their stories accurately in the first place? Then they wouldn't have to keep lying to each other.
Ching Zhao sat before her terminal, her eyes closed, thinking. Wang Mu was brushing Ching Zhao's hair. The tugs, the strokes, the very breath of the girl was a comfort to her. This was a time when Wang Mu could speak freely, without fear of interrupting her. And because Wang Mu was Wang Mu, she used hairbrushing time for questions. She had so many questions. The first few days her questions had all been about the speaking of the gods. Of course, Wang Mu had been greatly relieved to learn that almost always tracing a single wood grain line was enough. She had been afraid after that first time that Jing Zhao would have to trace the whole floor every day. but she still had questions about everything to do with purification. Why don't you just get up and trace a line every morning and have done with it? Why don't you just have the floor covered in carpet? It was so hard to explain that the gods can't be fooled by silly stratagems like that. What if there were no wood at all in the whole world? Would the gods burn you up like paper? Would a dragon come and carry you off? Qing Zhao couldn't answer Wang Mu's questions except to say that this is what the gods required of her. If there were no wood grain, the gods wouldn't require her to trace it. To which Wang Mu replied that they should make a law against wooden floors then, so that Qing Zhao could be shut of the whole business. Those who hadn't heard the voice of the gods simply couldn't understand. Today, though, Wang Mu's questions had nothing to do with the gods, or at least had nothing to do with them at first. What is it that finally stopped the Lusitania fleet? Asked Wang Mu. Almost, Jing Zhao simply took the question in stride. Almost, she answered with a laugh. If I knew that, I could rest. But then she realized that Wang Mu probably shouldn't even know that the Lusitania fleet had disappeared. How would you know anything about the Lusitania fleet? I can read, can't I? Said Wang Mu, perhaps a little too proudly. But why shouldn't she be proud? Qing Zhao had told her, truthfully, that Wang Mu learned very quickly indeed and figured out many things for herself. She was very intelligent, and Qing Zhao knew she shouldn't be surprised if Wang Mu understood more than was told to her directly. I can see what you have on your terminal, said Wang Mu, and it always has to do with the Lusitania fleet. Also, you discussed it with your father the first day I was here. I didn't understand most of what you said, but I knew it had to do with the Lusitania fleet. Wang Mu's voice was suddenly filled with loathing. May the gods piss in the face of the man who launched that fleet. Her vehemence was shocking enough. The fact that Wang Mu was speaking against Starway's Congress was unbelievable. Do you know who it was that launched the fleet? Asked Jing Zhao. Of course, it was the selfish politicians in Starway's Congress trying to destroy any hope that a colony world could win its independence. So Wang Mu knew she was speaking treasonously. Jing Zhao remembered her own similar words long ago with loathing. To have them said again in her presence and by her own secret maid was outrageous. What do you know of these things? These are matters for Congress, and here you are speaking of independence and colonies, and Wang Mu was on her knees, head bowed to the floor. Qing Zhao was at once ashamed for speaking so harshly. Oh, get up, Wang Mu. You're angry with me? I'm shocked to hear you talk like that, that's all. Where did you hear such nonsense? Everybody says it, said Wang Mu. Not everybody, said Qing Zhao. Father never says it. On the other hand, Demosthenes says that sort of thing all the time. Qing Zhao remembered how she had felt when she first read the words of Demosthenes, how logical and right and fair he had sounded. Only later, after Father had explained to her that Demosthenes was the enemy of the rulers and therefore the enemy of the gods, only then did she realize how oily and deceptive the traitor's words had been, which had almost seduced her into believing that the Lusitania fleet was evil. If Demosthenes had been able to come so close to fooling an educated, god-spoken girl like Qing Zhao, no wonder that she was hearing his words repeated like truth in the mouth of a common girl. Who is Demosthenes? Asked Wang Mu. A traitor who is apparently succeeding better than anyone thought. Did Starway's Congress realize that Demosthenes' ideas were being repeated by people who had never heard of him? Did anyone understand what this meant? Demosthenes' ideas were now the common wisdom of the common people. Things had reached a more dangerous turn than Qing Zhao had imagined. Father was wiser. He must know already. Never mind, said Qing Zhao. Tell me about the Lusitania fleet. How can I when it will make you angry? Qing Zhao waited patiently.